This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we're going to have one of the true great, great researchers into the lost past. He hasn't been on the show in so long that I don't think either of us wants to bother to say how long it has been, but it's been a while, too long, because Chris Dunn is truly one of the greats. He is to give you an idea of his background, he's a retired aerospace engineer. He's published dozens of articles on ancient technology. He's appeared on the History Channel, the Travel Channel, the Discovery Channel, the Learning Channel, and many others. He's the author of the classic and terribly important book, The Giza Power Plant, and also Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. We have interviewed about both of those, and I welcome you, Chris Dunn, to Dreamland.
Thank you, Whitley. It's nice to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I want to go back to the beginning. What drew your interest to the Great Pyramid in the first place?
Actually, it was a book that I picked up at a bookstore. It just kind of jumped out of the shelves to me. And it was Peter Tompkins' Secrets of the Great Pyramid, which was a seminal book on pyramid studies. And reading that book, the craftsman engineer in me resonated with the information that was being provided, because he was providing technical information. The people that he introduced in his book, who had done research in Egypt, seemed to have strong technical backgrounds, and so it was a pleasure to read. But as I was reading, there was something that I started to dawn on me, and that was that there's a lot of people out there that question the tomb theory, and they raise very, very valid points as to whether it is actually the truth. I ultimately concluded that the questions were valid, that the tomb theory is very weak, and when you consider the size of the Great Pyramid, and you know, it weighing almost 6 million tons, the precision with which it was built, exacting precision, where the joints are so tight that you couldn't even slip a piece of paper between them, on a lot of them. And then also the schematics of the interior design and architecture suggested that to me that it was actually a machine, only a machine that was on the scale of acres, and it had the precision of a machine. And so with that conclusion, the question then was, well, if it was a machine, what was the machine doing? And I ultimately landed on the concept of it being a power plant, and that each feature within the Great Pyramid performed a particular function, and that was how I approached it, more like a reverse engineering project, where say a company will bring a machine into their lab. They'll tear it apart. They'll examine every part of it to try to determine how it works. And in the case of the Great Pyramid, I was basically, you could consider me like a mechanic who comes across a machine in the middle of the jungle or something like that, and is trying to figure out what the machine did. And in order to do that, I had to draw on a lot of expertise and knowledge that I didn't have. And so over the years, I consulted with engineers, physicists in various fields, mechanical fields, electrical, microwave, you know, all these different specialties, civil engineers, I consulted with those. Aerospace engineers and acoustic engineers, and then, you know, all of these specialties provided a little clue or some information that I found valuable in trying to explain certain features. So ultimately, the Giza Power Plant was published in 1998. That was 21 years after the idea first came to me. And that 21 years was a bit of a struggle because it wasn't like I wasn't looking for a publisher. I had a manuscript. I was shopping it around. I was receiving many rejection slips, and they piled up over the years. But ultimately, the Barbara Han Clow of Bear & Company saw value in it. And I think against recommendations from her associates, she signed the book and it was published. So I'm just here because of all the very, very smart, clever, kind people who have helped me along the way. And it's like, you know, the tail end of my journey on the planet Earth. I feel only gratitude that I've been able to benefit from them.
It was decided that it must be a tomb back in the 19th century, I believe. Yes.
Yes, I think it was. That's been pretty much what you might call the accepted wisdom.
But the science has advanced fantastically in the 20th century, and yeah. you never really went into the Egyptological community because there's no there anymore. They're still in the 19th century. They have never looked at any of this in any way except that, and I just can't understand that. Why does this community not keep up with modern scientific advances that cast the pyramid clearly in a whole different light?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know the exact answer. I can only assume. But I think that that would be true of Western Egyptologists, not necessarily Egyptian Egyptologists, because the tide is turning in Egypt, and there are many Egyptian Egyptologists who are now looking at the lost technologies of ancient Egypt and seeing value in them. And why shouldn't they? Because essentially what it points out to people is that their ancestors were more advanced than what we've given them credit for. Much more advanced. Maybe in some ways more advanced than we are. We don't know. But it does open the question that young people in Egypt, especially engineers, are tuning into this lost technologies. And there are Egyptian engineers now. One is named Ahmed Adli, and he's a fine Egyptian engineer and has produced a YouTube channel with many different videos, and it's in Arabic, and the Arabic speaking world just keep demanding more. They absolutely love the content that they're being provided about their past.
And he also provided some other content, that is to say, the forward to your book.
Yes, he did. Yes, and thank you for pointing that out. Yes. And that's an interesting connection that there. I'm glad you brought that up, Whitley, because it's important.
Listen, I know it's important, and because I know it's important, I also know that before we get into it, it's time to take a brief break. We'll be right back. This is just a quick reminder to let you know Chris Dunn will be with us in the video chat room on April the 6th at 10 a.m. Pacific time. That's Saturday, April the 6th, 10 a.m. Pacific time, live to answer your questions. Of course, you have to be a subscriber to enter the chat room. So if you're not a subscriber and want to talk to Chris, why not subscribe? It's a wonderful place to be, unknowncountry.com. Don't forget the date, April 6th, 10 a.m. We're talking to Chris Dunn. We were just getting into the story of the foreword by Ahmed Adli of his book. Chris's new book is Giza, the Tesla Connection. His website is GizaPower.com, and it's incidentally an incredibly cool website and very worth going to. Okay, let's continue where we were left off, Chris.
Yes. After the Giza Power Plant was published, I engaged with some discussions on message boards, and then I kind of got a feel for what the level of interest or a bit or willingness to review the information that I put out by academia, Egyptologists, historians, and so it became very clear to me that I was like I hit a brick wall. There's no way they were going to accept it or even look at it seriously. So at that point, I decided that I would appeal to the Egyptians, particularly Egyptian engineers, because they would have the most to gain from this information being more widely known. And so I put an appeal in my book and challenged Egyptian engineers because to actually inspect their own artifacts in the same way that I did, to verify what I had discovered for themselves, not just take my word for it, but to do their own measurements. And then Ahmed Adli was a Egyptian engineer who took that to heart and did just that, to follow my path and to see if what I was writing about had any truth to it. And he concluded that it did. What I was saying was true. And he verified in one site, particularly the Serapeum, where they have these collections of huge granite boxes that are crafted to a high order of precision, and many other artifacts, such as the Ramses statues, the vases, many other different artifacts in Egypt. And so his work became very popular, and he had... It also showed an interest in the Giza power plant theory, and presented his theory that theory to a physicist at Cairo University, Dr. Ashraf Shabini, who claimed that it makes sense that the tomb theory is essentially doesn't really fit the evidence, an engineering systems approach to the concept of the pyramid being a power plant. It makes more sense. So that was very positive. And that work, that interest and that development in Egypt continues. It just hasn't stopped. So while you mentioned why aren't Egyptologists a little more progressive in their acceptance of new information. The most Western Egyptologists are not, it seems. But Egyptian Egyptologists are, with some exceptions, I would say. There are still those in Egypt who hold power, but who are a kind of sticking with the traditional theory of the pyramids being tombs.
Yeah, they're sort of colonized in a way, I think, because Egyptology, Western Egyptology, is very Eurocentric in the sense that it looks upon everything that has to do with the past as being primitive and simple compared to the modern world, and it will ignore anything that suggests anything else. And they don't understand that, you know, we left the colonies a long time ago because they're still in them.
Yeah, I mean, and that is another aspect of why this information is being accepted by the Egyptians, is that one reason they're looking at my work is because I don't detract from their culture and giving credit to other cultures. So I don't talk about Atlanteans or aliens, and I talk about the indigenous people in that area at the time. So if you look at the history of Egypt, you'll see that they have been invaded and colonized several times. You have the French, the English, the Germans. I mean, they're having their artifacts spirited away in the dead of night, and transported to museums around the world. They are arguing strenuously for the British Museum to send the Rosetta Stone back to them, because they, you know, that is one a treasured artifact for them. And then the bust of Nefertiti in the Berlin Museum is a treasured artifact that they want back. Whether they get it back eventually, I don't know. But still, it is that kind of mentality that you referred to, Whitley. And it's nationalism or chauvinism, that when you are stronger, a stronger nation, and you have power over a group of people, and then you look at how they perform work and what they produce, move past that and see that these things could not be produced with the tools that are in the archaeological record or in the ancient Egyptians' toolbox, be impossible to actually make those artifacts, and they can't see past that and look and recognize that there had to have been a much higher and more capable civilization at that time. Certainly, you know, our civilization is supported by specialties. The few actually support the many with the devices, technologies, and things like that. And that's what that's why we can live comfortably. Sorry.
No, I said, I just agreed. Yes, go ahead.
Yes. And so, yeah, we have to recognize that, you know, none of us have all the information. It takes sometimes people all across the world to solve a problem. And so I think the way we have looked at native people and they're in these, you know, these really ancient civilizations, And the way we look at them and the way we've treated them has been extremely disrespectful and also focus on self-interest or what they can gain from it.
Well, exactly. Now, I want to get back to the period itself. The pyramid, in fact, I think most of them, maybe all of the pyramids were built during what's known as the Old Kingdom. And something happened that caused the collapse of what on every measure had been a very stable society. And there is apparently, some have theorized that the explosion of Santorini, I believe the Greek island of Santorini, caused a tremendous upheaval in that it would have coated the whole area with a massive cloud of ash and dust. And I think the biblical references to this catastrophe are quite famous. And could that have had something to do with the loss of what looks to me like a very powerful science that was existing before that?
Oh, absolutely. If not Santorini, but certainly some other cataclysmic event that caused upheaval in the planet, disrupted the entire civilization. There was an extinction event. I mean, we know that those events have happened in our history. The question is how far back do you go? And now I think with the new information coming out about the Younger Dryas impact, and then there are other cataclysmic events. It answers so many questions when you consider that. That the Earth actually suffered an extinction event, and ours could too. It's just like the natural order of things. You know that occasionally you have a visitation from a very large object that strikes the planet and shakes things up,
or a huge solar flare could have done it too.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, incidentally, right now we are at the point of one of the 11-year, every 11-year cycle, there's the sun's magnetic field reverses. And during that period, there can be great solar flares, and we're absolutely not prepared. If another great solar flare occurred, it could conceivably really wipe out our civilization. It's fragile. Civilizations are fragile.
Yes, I mean we're not immortal. That's for sure.
No,
and history proves that. And so, depending on how far back you go, where there was one that would bring a civilization like in Egypt to its knees, it would be, I would say, tens of thousands, 10 or 20, 30,000 years earlier than the given date for the building of the pyramids, which was around 2500 BC. But if you go back further back than that, then you can find an explanation for why so much that must have existed to support that civilization no longer exists.
Would that be why there are no... There's no tools because they're were from so far in the past. They're gone.
Yes, I mean if you go on a building site, any building site it's been built and it's been functioning for several years, you don't find the tools that were used to build it. And so if you're going to be looking around the Great Pyramid for the tools that built it, you're not going to find them. So just after the construction, the tools would have been hauled off, held somewhere else, used it at another site, and then you know, when the cataclysm hit, who knows what happened to them? You know,
we're going to take another break, and when we come back, I want to ask Chris how old this civilization actually is. And what cataclysm he's talking about, because I don't think we're talking about the same cataclysm. And so we'll be right back. This is just a quick reminder to let you know Chris Dunn will be with us in the video chat room on April the 6th at 10 a.m. Pacific time. That's Saturday, April the 6th, 10 a.m. Pacific time, live to answer your questions. Of course, you have to be a subscriber to enter the chat room. So if you're not a subscriber and want to talk to Chris, why not subscribe? It's a wonderful place to be, unknowncountry.com. Don't forget the date, April 6th, 10 a.m. We're talking to Chris Dunn, GISA, the Tesla Connection. His website, GISAPower.com. Acoustical science and the harvesting of clean energy. And we're going to get into all of that in a few minutes. But right now, I want to go back in time, Chris, to the beginnings of Egyptian civilization as you see it, because the pyramid is obviously the work of a highly advanced technological and social culture. In other words, there were a lot of people involved, a lot of engineers. This was not something done by a very primitive, just recently post-hunter-gatherer civilization. So tell us about that civilization and when it was and what happened to it as you understand it.
Yes, I should state, though, at the outset that my position has always been that I'm not the person to decide when the pyramids were built or who built them. So the when and the who is not within my purview. What is the how and the why. In other words, how were these artifacts and structures constructed and for what reason? So really, if you look at it from a strictly engineering perspective, I don't care so much when or who built the Great Pyramid. My focus is on how it was built and why. So the that may seem like a cop out, and it probably is, because I am definitely, it's less ambiguous when you're talking about engineering than it's when you're trying to pin it down to a point in history, maybe, 5,000 years, 10,000, 15, 20, 30. Ultimately, I mean, right now, and in my book, I say that, you know, if the history of Egypt needs to be rewritten, then it's the Egyptians that need to rewrite it, not outsiders. And, you know, unfortunately, in the past, it has been outsiders that have written Egyptian history for us.
Well, that's very true, and they've written it in the way we discussed before, with the assumption that it was always very primitive. But when you look at the production of what it produced, it was not primitive. In fact, most of what it produced couldn't be created today, and I know not just the pyramid, but many of the temples and the other artifacts are beyond belief. And yet, we touched briefly on tools previously, and in all of this, there's not even a cartouche or anything that describes the tools.
Right. There's you know, that's one of the things. If you go to around a city, one of our cities, you don't see engravings on walls where you see a CNC machine or a milling machine or a lathe or something like that. that generally they are not the subject of fine art. People will, you know, make sculptures, reliefs of people rather than objects. so that we don't see them in their reliefs, in their artwork, doesn't surprise me. We don't see the tools in them.
We don't see them in the ground either. And if you go forward to the Roman era, to the Ptolemaic era, tools of various kinds and papyri and so forth begin to appear in profusion, but not earlier. Not when it was Egypt.
Right.
After it ceased to become Egypt, that sort of thing began to, you know, the same sort of artifacts that you find all over the ancient world. Only some of them in Egypt better preserved because it's so dry.
Yeah. And the answers to those questions, I think, I don't think we have them.
No.
I'm not sure if we will ever have them. We can only speculate. The only thing that we have are the imprints or the marks that the tools left in the igneous rock and the sedimentary rock that they were carving. And combining those tool marks and looking at also the geometry and precision with which these objects were crafted, then you can't conclude anything else other than they had to have had machine tools to create them. And, you know, this conversation that we're having today is not new. William Flinders Petrie, in his book, he described the existence of lathes, machine tools in ancient Egypt that would have been necessary to craft the artifacts that he was studying. So, and that was back in 1883. So the idea that the ancient Egyptians or the creators of these objects were, you know, blessed with machine tools is not a new idea. It's just not accepted by Egyptologists. And then, you know, I came along and I'm afraid I'm a bit of a troublemaker, and I started to push on that button, and I think, you know, the Egyptologists kind of hardened their position on it and just dismiss it out of hand while heaping mockery on Chris Dunn.
it's a closed culture with its own language and arts and its own meaning, and it is very self-defensive.
Yes, I mean, they behave rather angrily when people disagree with them for some reason. I mean,
my dad was a very wise man, and he was an attorney and had been in all kinds of things in his life. And he used to say, Whitley, never forget, when people get mad, it's usually because they're wrong.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's it. That's why I don't get mad.
Neither do I, of course.
Right. I don't like being wrong. I've been wrong too many times, but I've always corrected my mistakes, or tried to, when I knew about them. And nobody's perfect. And so if somebody points something out to me that I think is a value and I need to correct a mistake, I will do it. And I find that in my book, as you know, I corrected a few mistakes that I had made in my first book. And
yes.
And so, you know, that, and 20 years from now, somebody may correct the mistakes I made in the Tesla Connection.
I want to go back to the tools for a minute, because and we're going to lead into the power plant theory and your latest thinking from here. Because the absence of devices that seem relevant in the archaeological record seems to me to be explained in the book. Would that be fair to say, or am I going down the wrong path here?
I think there are reasons that make sense for why these things disappear. But as far as actual proof, it's a hypothesis, you know. When you look at the situation, the whole situation, you have an observation, an artifact. You make an observation of the artifact. I concluded that there had to have been machine tools to create this artifact, and I produce measurements to show how precise the artifact is, its geometry, et cetera, et cetera. And so that is actually circumstantial evidence to say, well, you know, they had the action of a machine tool, and because the only thing that I have to make that argument is the object that was made by the machine tool. Now, the question then becomes in many people's minds, well, where are the machines? And so for those who are, you know, kind of orthodox, they're not willing to consider the implications of what accepting such an idea would mean, because basically, if they accept that idea that machine tools existed in prehistory and these things indeed were, you know, the civilization was much more advanced, then all the history books would have to be rewritten. And and they would have to say that they were wrong. And that and human nature seems to dictate that people will avoid that or be resistant to it. Sometimes their whole life they will be resistant to admitting that they were wrong. Now, when it comes to the Egyptians, though, their motives are a little different, and I understand those. And that is that they're elevating their ancestors on the world stage in terms of the progress of technologies, the progress of science. And they're beginning to see and recognize their true place in the world. So how long this revolution will go on, I mean, it's more of a, I think right now it's more of a grassroots revolution. Because when I started out, there weren't many people with my background who had computers, let alone were entering message boards and discussing things. But now there are thousands, if not millions, of technical type people, craftsmen, engineers, who are finding their voice online and strongly supporting the nature of these artifacts and claiming for them to have been made by machines. So it is a more of a grassroots. Eventually it will percolate up, I should imagine.
There's a few things that do exist in terms of possible technological artifacts, like the Dendera light bulb, and it's a kind of, it's off your subject, I know, but you've probably looked at that relief, and what do you think of it? I mean, do you think it could be an indication of the existence of an ability to handle electrical energy?
Well, I think it's a fascinating relief. You know, this is the It's a fine example of the natural order of things when it comes to who writes history. And generally, history is written by the victors, and or it's written by those who got there first, right? And so the people who got there first at the Dendera Temple and interpreted those reliefs, they have their cosmology, their basically interpret it from a symbolic perspective. And that interpretation is held. You know, when you have those who have come later with more of a technological persuasion, in other words, they interpret the world around them from a technologist perspective, and they look at the same relief, they interpret it differently, but their voice is dismissed because the voice that came first has more power and authority. And really, at the end of the day, there's only one way to prove whether what the images are supposed to represent, and that is to actually interview the people who crafted them onto the wall, and have them testify as to their intention.
Well, that's right. Well, of course, with the ancient Egyptians, can you be absolutely sure? Because I remember, where is that those depictions of apparent modern devices are on the rafter of one of the temples. So maybe it'll turn out that time travel is possible and they did it.
But well, maybe. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the what they call the Dendera light bulb and also the Abydos helicopter. I had taken some close-up images of that. I was using a telephoto lens on my camera. And you can definitely see that is a combination of different reliefs. I think they call it a palimpsest, where one relief is covered over with some kind of a gypsum or
another relief,
right? And then then carved to represent something else. So you know, it's uncanny the way it looks, and people get all excited about it. I really don't get that excited about that myself.
Well, I have a lot of problems with practical problems with believing that time travel is even possible. The only way we could travel into the future would be if we accelerated to something close to the speed of light and then returned, because our time in the ship we accelerated would be moving much more slowly than the time on Earth. So if you went, I don't want to go down that road. I've never really talked about it on the show, and we should actually at some point, but there's never been a book written about that possibility. Okay, so anyway, that's neither here nor there. I think it's time to get into Nikola Tesla, which is, of course, the core and heart of this whole new story that you're telling, the acoustic science and the harvesting of clean energy. And it's an important story because, obviously, there's something we're missing about here, this energy. But, you know, we've come to the end of the free part of the show, and we'll go on with the subscribers, and we're going to get very deeply into the Pyramid Tesla connection. Free Dreamlanders, I would like to thank you very much for being with us. I hope you have found this discussion as interesting as I have. And Chris Dunn's book, again, is Giza, the Tesla Connection. His website is gizapower.com. Chris, let me think about how to get into this, because it's such a complex story. Okay. I think the best way to start is to simply ask you how you see what exactly did Tesla do that suggests not necessarily that he knew something based on the Great Pyramid, but there is a connection between what he did and what the pyramid was intended to do.
Okay. The, you know, can we go back a little bit before I get into that?
Oh, sure. Of course.
You were talking about time travel, right?
And it was, yeah.
And it reminded me of when I was in the latter stages of finishing up my book. And it was like the past kind of rushed forward and the future rushed backward. And I was in this space where they were, the past and the future were present at the same time as I was finishing the book. So it was kind of like, you know, where you look at the past, you learn from the past, but then my state of mind right now is more focused on what's going to happen next, what happens in the future. And so I was, I think I start out by introducing the concept of energy production, how it has taken place over the century or more, and what changes could happen in the future. How do we do things better? And I'll start out by saying that, you know, in 2021, in the United States alone, they had quarried enough coal to be burned in power plants to build a pyramid 76 times the size of the Great Pyramid. That is a lot of coal. But then if you look at how we are producing electricity, we're extracting coal, we're burning it, we're boiling water, creating steam, blowing turbines, and then in turn they turn generators, and we harvest the electrons from the generators and then feed it into the power grid. So there is a Tesla connection, I mean, with electricity, there's no denying that. With the Great Pyramid, there is a Tesla connection, not necessarily with an induction motor or anything like that, or alternating currents or anything like that, but also two forms of technology that he had described, and one of them he had demonstrated, the other one he was hoping to demonstrate. And one was what he called the earthquake machine. That's a machine that was it was a hydroelectric driven, or it was a device that would impart a vibration into a structure, and the it would be timed with the structure's natural frequency. And so what happened was it builds up a resonance in the structure. The structure could actually be destroyed. And there was an account of him doing that in a building that was almost shook apart, and he had to break the machine and stop it because people around were thinking that there was an earthquake going on. Okay, so the Tesla connection in the Great Pyramid for the earthquake machine is in the subterranean chamber. In the subterranean chamber, it drives vibrations into the pyramid and also into the earth. Something new in the Tesla connection that was not in the Giza power plant was the source of the electrons and how they were released. So the work of a physicist at NASA, his name is Friedemann Freund, comes into play. he was researching earthquake lights and actually discovered a new physics in terms of the underlying physics of how these earthquake lights happened. And they were it was the stress on igneous rock in the Earth's lithosphere, where there are dormant electronic charge characters that carriers that if you stress them, they would shoot to the surface. And basically what you have is an ionization of the air at the surface of the Earth, and they show up as earthquake lights. Interestingly, they seek the highest point on the surface. So if you've got a couple of pyramids laying around that are fairly big and high, then those electrons will be attracted to those pyramids. So the question now is, does this, what they call the Freund effect, is it responsible for some of the observations and the anecdotal observations in the past of electrical activity around the Great Pyramid or around the Giza Plateau? And I mean, that I believe so. Now, Freund is a lovely old guy. He's probably in his 80s, getting up to 90s now. I'll actually see him in a couple of weeks. But his research was into earthquake lights, particularly to be able to forecast when an earthquake was going to happen, because these earthquake lights would light, you know, the surfaces of the Earth would light up to 10 days before the plates gave way and there was an earthquake. He was not interested in pyramids. I'm not sure he's even interested in them now. He just wanted an early warning system to say, you know, life and property when an earthquake is set off. So those are the electrons, and I think it's probably the most important discovery of the century, though not many people are talking about it. But if you consider that if you could replace our traditional methods for generating electricity and actually start to release those electrons under our feet, you would have a new source for power, and could probably solve the power crunch that we're, you know, a shortage that we're going to be having if everything goes electric.
Yes, which it, I mean, we are doing that because right now the blockchain technology is using vast, unbelievable amounts of power, and artificial intelligence with its ultra high density power needs is doing the same thing. We are power mad. And therefore, soon are going to be power hungry. You're quite right.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. This relates to Tesla's experiments that caused such a kerfluffle when people saw barbed wire fences and so forth began to spark. And could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the other part of the Tesla connection is, if you relay back to Freund's research, and the listener, the viewers can access a lecture that he gave in Christchurch, New Zealand, in I think it was 2016. But
is there a link on your website to that?
I should be able to get one up, but a person could Google the name Freund, Freund, and then a TEDx talk in Christchurch.
Okay, we'll have a link to that on the show, folks.
Right, that is, and it's a great introduction to his work, and he gives it at a level that a lay person can understand. So. People shouldn't have any problem understanding it. But as a part of his research, he set up a lab experiment, and essentially he got a hydraulic press and a long piece of slab of granite. He attached the one end, was held in the press, and pressure was put on the end. He ran a wire from one end to the other, and he had a copper cap on the other end and a multimeter or an oscilloscope in between to measure the current flow. So by putting pressure on the granite, that the electrons flowed for a long time without any further activity, they continued to flow. So he was able to prove his physics at that point by lab experiment. But he's not the only one. His experiment was replicated by a Japanese team of scientists, and they were able to replicate what Freund did and supported his observations. So it's good science. It's solid. It's not just a theory anymore.
So how does it relate to the pyramid?
It relates to the pyramid in identifying a source of electrons that if you shake the earth underneath the pyramid, then those electrons will shoot up and you can gather them in the pyramid and distribute them to where you need them. And then that brings in the other Tesla technology that was not brought to fruition. That was the Wardenclyffe Tower, with the wireless transmission of electricity. So it is kind of a futuristic in a way. I mean, I think you have to stretch your imagination if you're problem solving. You can't stay in the past. You have to look into the future.
And when they must have been transmitting electricity wirelessly.
I would definitely say that is a very strong possibility.
And would there be any health effects to people in the way, do you think?
I would assume not. It depends on, I mean, there's electricity all around us in the air. We have electromagnetic radiation. We're actually swimming in it.
Yes.
But that's very true. Very weak. It's very weak, but I mean, as far as devices that would be used to draw that energy into it, I mean, that's another matter altogether. I don't think you just essentially broadcast it out without providing people the means to collect it wirelessly and then use it. I mean, you look at devices like the UAPs, you know, the videos that show these UAPs that perform amazing feats of aeronautic capability. So traveling very, very quickly.
Yes.
Turning on a dime. And, you know, it's like unbelievable abilities that we...
Oh, listen.
We don't have.
I've been in that struggle to figure that out for many years, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
But even if we haven't figured it out yet in our generation, maybe future generation will. I mean, when you consider what was available when we were kids and what is available now, it's like night and day. And the culture has changed significantly because of it. So, you know, you go 80 years into the future, what's the world going to look like then, the way technology progresses? I have great hope for the future generation. That's why I dedicated my book to the future generation.
You have to, because the present generation has got its feet stuck in the mud when it comes to this.
Well,
I want to move on to a couple of things. One, what you found from the recording you made in the King's Chamber, and then we're going to talk about Mazers.
Okay. So
first, let's talk about the recording.
The recording that I made was it was made in 1995, and I had I paid money to be inside the King's Chamber and left alone and had the lights turned off. I had taken with me a guitar tuner, a tape recorder, and an RF counter. It was an old Radio Shack RF counter, because I wanted to see if there was any electromagnetic radiation that was generated if the granite was stimulated. And the way I stimulated the granite was by chanting at a particular frequency. Now, the chamber has a natural frequency that's close to A on the musical scale, 440. So I had all this, all these little pieces of equipment in there, and I set up the tape recorder on a slab of rock next to the coffer. They had not turned out the lights, and I wanted to get to work. And so I walked crawled out onto the great, what they call the great step at the top of the Grand Gallery, and yelled down for the guard to turn off the light. Then I walked back crawled back into the chamber and got back there just as the lights went out.
Luckily, I think.
Right. And so then I started to chant, I wasn't comfortable taking readings with the RF counter, because they had installed fans. The fans were still running, so there would be electrical noise within the chamber. So I abandoned that part of the project. But the recording on the tape recorder was very interesting. Back in my hotel room, I played it back, and I had the guitar tuner. And when I was actually walking, just my steps on the floor, walking out and crawling into the Grand Gallery, the chamber rang, and the frequency was 440. And I found that interesting. When I was chanting, there was definite overtones, very, very high frequencies that were being generated, because one of the theories in my book was that the beams, the granite beams above the King's Chamber, were all tuned to different frequencies, that they were in harmony with each other. And so if they were stimulated to move, they would vibrate naturally at a specific frequency. And if you look at the cross section of the King's Chamber and you look at the beams above, you'll see that they're all different, and the tops of them are gouged and cut into different shapes. And I propose that they were cut that way in order to achieve a particular result, and that was the frequency that they vibrate. So that was an interesting discovery. It's kind of confirmed the proposal that the beams were tuned, and they were responding at a higher frequency than the base frequency that I was generating.
So now let's go on to this. What I'm trying to get at is basically to how the pyramid was used in a practical sense. And we know already that the energy that it produced was probably transmitted through the air. Mm-hmm. But let's now talk about the idea that the King's Chamber was a maser.
Right. Yeah. The one of the, you know, my, obviously the, I didn't arrive at that instantly. It was a...
No, I wouldn't think so.
It was just examining the evidence and measuring, you know, where you have one piece of evidence in one location in the pyramid and then other pieces of evidence elsewhere. The major evidence in the King's Chamber, to me, was the northern shaft. It was in the northern shaft and the southern shaft. These are small shafts that come in on an angle in the north. They go around the Grand Gallery, but then there are about four bends before they reach a point in the King's Chamber where they enter the King's Chamber. And the dimensions of that shaft, the northern shaft, is such that they would be suitable to be used as a waveguide, in that the dimensions approximate the wavelength of hydrogen. The wavelength of hydrogen is 8.309 inches, and the width of the northern shaft is 8.4 inches. the height is 4.8, and a waveguide would be approximately... the height will be approximately half the width for it to be suitable. there could have been some, I think there could have been a metal liner installed in those shafts. It needs further research to actually determine that. And there have been other features in the Great Pyramid discovered since the Giza power plant was published, and that is the existence of a large void, which appears to actually encircle the northern shaft, or run very, very close to it. So there are things about the maser, as I described it in the Giza power plant, that were incomplete in a way. Mm-hmm. And then the existence of this large void stimulated an idea with a friend of mine who's a aerospace engineer and familiar with masers. And he said that that void would serve as a, what he called, a preamp.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I need to tell those listeners who don't know what a maser is what we're talking about. A maser is basically a laser that concentrates and projects electrical energy. Would that be fair to say electrons?
Yes.
Microwaves.
Yeah, microwave region of the spectrum, yes.
Right, exactly. Okay, so let's go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. So so anyway, a preamp would boost the signal before it actually came into the King's Chamber. Opposite the northern shaft is a large bulbous opening that I... compared to a microwave horn antenna. It's very unique that it should exist there, but it's certainly there. The it looks like a catcher's mitt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the pinning down the kind of maser that it was, and the gas that was used, identifies hydrogen clearly. So then we go into the Queen's Chamber and start to look at it as a source for the hydrogen gas that would have been necessary for the maser to work. And we find a lot of evidence there. And that's been a subject of long discussion in terms of the shafts that are come into this chamber. They were blocked on both ends. They had no beginning and no end. But they, but now in 1872, they detected a hole. Wayman Dixon, 1872, he was in the Queen's Chamber poking around, found something unusual, and had his guy chisel out the limestone, and they found the opening to the southern shaft. And then they did the same on the northern wall and found a shaft there too. So it's been a long mystery where these shafts went to, because they couldn't find any openings on the outside. Unlike the King's Chamber, they found openings on the outside of the King's Chamber, but not the Queen's Chamber. So for many years, nobody knew where they ended or where they came out, if they came out at all. As it turns out, they did not reach the outside. They terminated just above the level of the King's Chamber. And the and that was discovered in 1993 by a German robotics engineer. His name's Rudolf Gantenbrink. And he found what is now famously become known as the Gantenbrink's door. So that kind of exploration was fed right into the theory, or the reverse engineering project that I was involved with, and in my opinion, provided strong support for it. That research continues. There's more. I mean, there was Gantenbrink in 93. In 2002, there was another exploration of the southern shaft by iRobot. They call it Pyramid Rover. And on that expedition, they drilled through what they call Gantenbrink's door to see what was on the other side of it. Now, I should mention that the Rudolf Gantenbrink found that there were two metal pins that came through the block that was blocking the shaft. and one of them had been broken off. The other one was kind of in weak. They were tapered. And there is, there's a good reason for that. They just didn't, they weren't installed that way, let's put it that way. I made a replica of the Gantenbrink's door, and I talk about that in my book, but the replica,
yes.
I made of Gantenbrink's door when I actually installed the copper. I made them out of copper. I don't know what material they made. The ancient Egyptians made it out, but I made them out of copper. But the amount of pressure that I had to put on those pins in order to bend them 90 degrees, the shape or the way that those existing in the Great Pyramid, if you were to put that the same kind of pressure on those, they would have snapped. So it's like it's obvious that when they created, when they formed those pins, they were not in the same shape that they are now. That is a long story. Discussing the introduction, I actually proposed in the Giza power plant that each shaft, north and south, delivered certain chemicals into the chamber. The chemicals mixed and boiled off hydrogen. The chemicals were a dilute hydrochloric acid in the south shaft and hydrated zinc in the north shaft.
Now, we should be able to find some traces of those chemicals in the shafts if we looked, wouldn't we?
Yes, I think at least evidence that they would have once existed by any changes that you see in the materials.
Yes,
there's more expeditions being planned for future explorations of these shafts, and so I've been privy to some discussions and been able to provide some input. Hopefully, I can't announce anything here, but
yes.
I hope that that certain procedures are followed and information is gathered to provide whether certain features exist or whether certain substance exists.
Well, of course, you and I both know that there will be powerful forces attempting to prevent anything like that, and certainly any release of such data. So I hope it works. That's all I can say.
Yes, now, I don't know. I'm not. I know that the political forces that you refer to, from my perspective, I'm not sure, but it seems to me that they are not as powerful as they used to be. So I'm not.
Yeah, they aren't. And, you know, they're the same type of political forces. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. And if there's a connection, I don't know what it is.
Well,
or much care. But let me just finish that are causing this sort of upwelling of disclosure of UFO information and other secrets all over the world seem to be coming to the surface. Maybe this one will too. And maybe there's something about human psychology and the place we're in the evolution of mankind that is drawing this material forth. For those of you who don't understand the engineering, and why would you? I mean, I'm not being condescending at all. I don't think a maser requires a medium in order to function, and that's what the hydrogen gas would have been about, right?
So the hydrogen would have been energized and driven to a higher energy state, and just like a maser or a laser, the acronym is light amplification through stimulated emission radiation. So an atom in a laser or a maser, the electrons would be driven to a higher energy orbit, and then they would be stimulated to return to their original orbit through the input of a signal of the same frequency and type. So you're looking at a chamber that is filled with highly energized hydrogen and a input signal coming in from the north shaft and stimulating emission of photons from those electrons and then carrying them through the southern shaft to the outside.
Now, in a modern hydrogen maser, which is, by the way, folks, one of the best kinds of masers there are, because it's very stable, high frequency stability, and meaning that the microwaves there are emitted are always very much at the same frequency, but this requires something like a cylinder. Come on, Whitley, your old brain's got to function. Okay, such as quartz. In other words, there's got to be something to collect this. And what would you say would be doing that in the King's Chamber?
Well, we don't know everything about what may have existed in the King's Chamber. What we have in there now is a granite coffer, a granite box. And there's a physicist who contacted me after the Giza power plant was published in 2003. Sent me a series of emails where he was looking into the Great Pyramid, advising me on certain features within the Great Pyramid. We were actually hoping to be able to take a research team over to Egypt so that he could gather further information, but that that effort did not pan out. But he had he had surmised or proposed that the box inside the King's Chamber was a secondary resonator that would have been necessary if it was functioning as a thermoacoustic energy machine. So if you have thermoacoustics involved, then you have a you have like a heat engine, and you can perform work. I'm not necessarily convinced of that, because at the time when we were looking at it, we were not taking into account the Freund effect, or the fact that there were a lot of electrons already flowing through the pyramid and probably having an influence on whatever process was taking place. But the bottom line is, for me, is that I think there's enough information there for people to get really serious about taking this further and outlining a research plan, a plan of research where we're that not just an acoustic studies inside the Great Pyramid are perfected or are performed by experts, but also the Freund effect and its influence on inside the Great Pyramid. And there was a Russian research team, I think it was 2018, they published a paper that that showed that electromagnetic energy that is flowing through the Great Pyramid would focus in the center, close to where the King's Chamber was. So, the idea of the electrical potential in the Earth and the behavior of electrons once it reaches the surface and enters into the structure of a pyramid, I think is significant.
Folks, we are talking about basically two different sciences. Modern science, which breaks with nature and seeks to exploit it. That is to say, we draw coal and oil up out of the ground. We produce enormous amounts of heat in order to generate electricity with these substances. And we use the planet. This other science is much more sophisticated, because it partners with nature fundamentally. The pyramid, if it was used as Chris believes it was, and I think his evidence is getting stronger every year, the pyramid didn't do that. It wasn't an exploiter. It took advantage instead of a process of concentrating energies that are part of nature and using them without exploiting the planet. So it's a fundamentally different, you could use the pyramid for thousands of years and you wouldn't have a vast ruin around it at all, like you do it with an oil field or a coal mine. Is that correct?
It is. Yeah. In chapter 9, I talk about restoring the Great Pyramid or building a new pyramid.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, but right. You already answered it, so go right ahead.
I get into that. And there was a quote that a quantity surveyor in England sent to me, and his expertise is actually providing quotes for the building of power plants. And so he was fascinated by the Giza power plant, and he sent me a quote, which I actually I used in my book. But he claimed that it would be $25 billion to build the Great Pyramid. And, you know, the interesting thing is that in 2021, I met with a couple of Egyptian officials and that were involved in the Skam Pyramid mission. And one of them asked me if the Great Pyramid could be restored to its original function. And that was the first time anybody had asked me that question. I certainly wasn't expecting it coming from an Egyptian official. And so I was like, that is a good question. I'm going to have to think about that. And I did think about that because previously I didn't think it would be possible. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, if the politics would change, or, you know, if the science was worked out and proven, if certain techniques, technologies could be improved or discovered, developed, that it would be definitely within the range of our abilities to do that. But tomorrow, no. 10 years from now, I don't know. 20, I don't know. Could be 100 years from now.
We may need it before then.
Well, I think we do. I mean, you know, when you think about what we're faced with in terms of the energy delivery system, I believe that, you know, if an electric car manufacturer wants to be successful and continue selling electric cars, they should look into building power plants that will provide the electrons for those cars to function. And so, you know,
perhaps even through the air.
Yes. Look at that too. I mean, I think all of these, we can't be stuck in the past, you know.
No.
We've been burning coal for over 100 years, creating electrons.
And look at the world around us. We're running out of time, obviously.
Yeah.
We've got to find new things. And Chris, we're coming to the end of the show. And, you know, obviously you and I could talk together for hours. But nevertheless, we do the an hour and a half on Dreamland, and that seems to be enough for the listeners. And so what I want to say here is that I think you are a brilliant pioneer, and like all pioneers, you're pushing the boulder up the hill, but you've kept going. And Giza, the Tesla connection, acoustic science, and the harvesting of clean energy is a brilliant book. And not only should you read it, folks, but we need to get ourselves energized. And right now, if you sat down and wrote a congressman about this book, it would be put in what they call the wavy file, which is where the weird letters go. So we all have to keep pushing, though, to talk to our friends. And if you're in the sciences, take an open your mind to this possibility. Because there is a new world coming, whether we like it or not. Either humankind's going to be born, still born into this new world, or we're going to be reborn into it. I choose reborn. And I think pioneers like Chris Dunn do too.
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
Thank you so much for being on the show with us. It was just awesome, Chris.
Oh, thank you, Whitley. I enjoyed it very much.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova.
Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.